This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Hey, Magic 8 Ball, what's going to happen with this economy? Reply, hazy. Try again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Riznall. It is Thursday today, the 19th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am honestly not sure how this happened, but Mitchell Hartman has somehow found himself assigned to the Marketplace desk of economic peril. He told us yesterday about some Delta-induced sag in what's known as high-frequency data, near real-time indicators of what's going on in this economy. And today, because it's Thursday, it's first-time jobless claims. The trend, to be clear, over the past month or so, has been really good. Last week, the number of people filing for unemployment benefits for the first time fell to 348,000, the lowest since the middle of March a year ago. And total claims in all government jobless programs is down to 11.7 million. But, again, from the desk of maximum peril, Mitchell tells us there is a potentially nasty shock lurking inside that number.
You can see the latest jobless claims numbers as a glass half full. Mark Hamrick at Bankrate says unlike earlier in the pandemic, when millions were getting laid off every week,
layoffs have not really been the overarching concern with respect to the economy.
But there is a big concern looming. Emergency federal pandemic benefits are about to expire, says Annalise Goger at the Brookings Institution.
On Labor Day, anyone who normally wouldn't qualify for their state unemployment, which is quite a lot of people that were impacted by the pandemic, lose their benefits.
That's nearly 5 million people right now, including
anyone who's a gig worker, contract worker, self-employed, maybe worked part-time and didn't earn enough to qualify.
Another 4 million or so long-term unemployed are getting federal benefits because they ran out of state benefits. And everyone on unemployment right now gets an extra $300 a week from the feds. All told, that's more than $6 billion in weekly federal benefits that vanish in 2.5 weeks.
This really has a big impact on low-income families.
Jim Sullivan is an economist at Notre Dame.
And so we're likely to see when current benefits are cut off that poverty will rise. Poverty will rise in the short run.
And the economy will take a hit too. Though Mark Hamrick at Bankrate says the labor market does keep getting better.
We do know that there is a record number of job openings out there for those who are either inclined or compelled to look for work.
But even by the most optimistic forecast, it'll take a while for the long-term unemployed and those who've dropped out of the labor market to get back to work again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One of the lesser known but really interesting and relevant economic indicators that the Census Bureau keeps track of for us is something called business formation, literally new businesses getting started. And the United States has been in something of a slump there, a really long slump, until now, basically. There were 4.3 million applications for new businesses last year, the most since the Census Bureau has been keeping track. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Most of us have reached some kind of breaking point during this pandemic. Kelly Clancy's happened while teaching political science to college students from her basement in Nebraska.
All of a sudden, I felt water dripping down
from the ceiling.
minutes. And I went upstairs and my daughter had dumped out her water cup and she was like, I made a beach in our living room.
Teaching with three kids at home wasn't working. So Clancy moved her family to Texas, where her parents live, and started a business called Epilogue Editing and Consulting.
I need to do something different because I can't keep teaching like the world is normal when when it's not.
Solo ventures like these are typical of the kind created during an economic downturn. But what explains the recent explosion? Ben Jones, a professor of entrepreneurship at Northwestern University, says it's because of things like low interest rates, government stimulus, and also...
There's been a huge shift in the nature of demand in the economy.
Demand to solve new problems with new goods and services. But a growing share of new business applications are for those that plan to hire workers, up more than 15% from 2019. Thing is, economic growth isn't guaranteed. Take restaurants. A lot of them are opening, but a lot of them have closed. John Haltewanger is an economist at the University of Maryland.
If we end up basically having the same kind of businesses that we had before, and we went through all this disruption, that's pretty costly.
And unfortunately...
What's the most likely outcome for a startup? Actually, it's not going to survive.
It means it'll be years before economists can sort through data on openings, closings, and hirings to figure out the actual impact of all these new business applications. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today was kind of meh, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The center of the economic universe shifts to Jackson Hole, Wyoming next week, a little gathering put on there every year, except last year, of course, by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Lots of papers, lots of big picture economic discussions and speeches, the most eagerly awaited speech of which is invariably given by the chair of the Federal Reserve. The incumbent's name, of course, is Jay Powell. And the Powellian tea leaves to be read this year. I don't even know if that's a word, Powellian. Anyway, his speech is going to center on what's known in Fed speak as the taper. That's what we're going to be looking for. When and how the Fed is going to start slowing down its big bond buying program and in so doing, start pulling back some of the extraordinary support the Fed's been giving to this economy. So we thought it might be a good idea to explain how those bond purchases actually help this economy and why the Fed figures it's going to have to cut back. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser explains what's going on.
Think of the economy as a giant water slide. The Fed has been pumping water down that slide to keep it going, buying at least $120 billion a month in bonds. Ann Owen teaches economics at Hamilton College.
They're flooding the economy with money, and because of that, it will be easier for consumers to get loans with lower interest rates as well as firms.
And those firms could use their loans to expand, maybe hire more workers. But the Fed can't keep pumping up the economy forever. Economist Claudia Sahm at the Jane Family Institute says at some point, consumers and businesses will be going down that economic water slide just fine on their own.
We're going to get to the finish line, not with the Fed flooding us down the path all the way, because we might overshoot and hit the wall at the end of the water slide.
In other words, the Fed might overstimulate the economy, but it can't just suddenly stop sending water down the slide.
You'd really burn your backside if the water suddenly got turned off.
Ken Kuttner teaches economics at Williams College. He says investors could get burned if the Fed suddenly turned off its bond-buying spigot.
They would like to be well-primed, well-prepared for anything that's going to happen. And that's why your Fed officials are starting to make very cautious statements.
So they're trying to telegraph the gradual tapering off of their bond buying months in advance. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Years ago today, the Business Roundtable, 180-something CEOs of some of the biggest companies in this economy, issued a document called A Statement on the Purpose of a Corporation. No longer, the group said, would companies be all about maximizing shareholder value. They would, and this is a quote, benefit all stakeholders, customers, employees, suppliers, communities, and shareholders. Since then, we've had a global pandemic, still having it, of course, and there is an ongoing reckoning in this country around racial justice. So, have these companies held up their commitments? Turns out people track this stuff. One of them is Otis Rowley. He's a senior vice president of the U.S. Equity and Economic Opportunity Initiative at the Rockefeller Foundation. It's good to have you on, sir.
It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So as you survey the corporate America landscape in light of the past 2 years, what kind of score do you give them in terms of meeting the obligations of what they had set out to do in that statement a couple of years ago?
Oh, wow. So it's in terms of actually meeting the obligation, I would really have to give them a C minus. The obligation in and of itself, the statement was powerful and moving. But so much still needs to be done in terms of their operations, their programs, and their funds actually meeting the needs of the community.
Let's break that down a little bit, because the temptation, of course, and look, I'm painting with a broad brush here, but the temptation, of course, for corporate America is to, in the vernacular, throw money at the problem, right, and try to solve it that way. But it's a more nuanced issue.
Oh, most definitely. You know, there's been almost $50 billion that's been committed toward advancing racial equity. Only about $250 million of that has actually been spent or obligated in real specific initiatives. We need to see them paying their fair share in taxes and advocating for progressive tax codes. We need really fair wages. 53 million Americans, or 40% of all workers, are earning low wages, and Black and Latinx Americans disproportionately so. And then finally, I really think it's just crucial that we see real investing in financial products that offer smaller loans. A lot of times banks and others don't really find it profitable to process a small loan, and, you know, $250,000 or less. But that's often the difference between aspiration and reality for a lot of small, particularly small Black and Latinx businesses and entrepreneurs.
Do you think it's fair to be checking in on this after only 2 years? And yes, 2 years is a long time and got to hold people's feet to the fire, but we're trying to remedy a generations-long issue.
I definitely think it's fair. You ask any corporate leader, I don't care about the sector, they would not wait 2 years to check on whether they are making progress as it relates to any component of their work that affects their bottom line. And so whether it is the for-profit or nonprofit sector, you need constant information. What is watched gets done. What is measured gets done. We need to fail fast, learn fast, fix fast to help to remedy decades and decades, if not centuries, of historically racist, structurally racist systems that have prevented people of color, Black and Latinx, indigenous people of color from having access to capital and credit. So, no, it is not too soon.
What are you looking for as markers of progress as you sit and you try to keep track of what corporate America is doing to make good on its pledge to rethink the nature of a corporation, but also racial equity and social justice? What are your markers? What are your indicators?
Great question. So pay equity, racial, ethnic diversity data, educational and training programs and access to them, the community investments, true community investments, any anti-discriminatory policies, and then numbers, hard numbers in terms of access to capital and credit, particularly along gender and race data points, so that you know whether or not banks are actually lending to women and to Black, Indigenous, and people of color in a real and substantive way.
You know, it occurs to me, just as a way to wrap this up, what we're really talking about here is redefining, or perhaps defining, I guess, maybe, the idea of corporate citizenship.
Very much so. And ultimately, it is, do we in fact start to live up to our ideals and vision of what America can and should be? And that profit alone is not a measurement of their success. Having a real emphasis on a commitment to and in diversity, equity, and inclusion is a way to have them finally live up to being true citizens.
Otis Rowley is the senior vice president at the Rockefeller Foundation. He covers U.S. equity and economic opportunity initiative there. Mr. Rowley, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
Man, I really thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation.
Coming up.
Not even a friends and family discount.
Seriously? First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 66 today, about 0.2%, closed at 34,894. The NASDAQ added 15 points, about a 10%, 14,541. The S&P 500 found 5 points in the couch cushions, about a 10%, 44.5 there. Toyota plans to take a whole bunch of its manufacturing capacity offline next month. It will cut production by 40% in its home base of Japan. The reason is the by now familiar shortage of microprocessors that go into those computers on wheels that we all drive around. Both Ford and GM said this week that they too are scheduling some downtime at North American facilities. Toyota reversed 4%. Ford dropped almost 2.4%. GM declined 3.4%. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.24%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Did you see the news from Facebook today? They've got a new virtual reality app that'll let you feel like you're sitting around a table in a conference room having an actual meeting with your colleagues instead of staring at squares on a computer screen. First of all, no thank you very much to that VR meeting thing. But also, to be honest, the Delta variant means we are going to be doing some kind of remote work for a while yet. So companies are getting serious about making it work well rather than just making it work. And there is a whole fleet of consultants eager to cash in. Marketplace's Matt Levin takes us inside the remote work industrial complex.
I've been remote since March of last year. And yeah, some parts have been a struggle. Punctuating every coworker conversation with the right Slack emoji, resisting the siren song of the 3 p.m. nap. Maybe I'm just not cut out for remote work.
Here's what we're going to do for you, Matt. You ready? You take the personality assessment. It'll take you 6 minutes.
Matt Pepsel is vice president of partner growth at the Predictive Index. Predictive calls itself a talent optimization platform. It works with big companies to screen job applicants based on personality traits. I'm taking their test now.
Please read the words in the list below and check those that you feel describe the way you are expected to act by others at work. All right. Social. Meh. Neat. I hope not.
Predictive offers a more scientific version of a BuzzFeed quiz. You know, the ones that tell you what Harry Potter house you belong to. But instead of Gryffindors and Hufflepuffs, there are work personality types like Mavericks and Collaborators, updated with tips on how to manage them remotely. Who should lead the Zoom meeting? Who could use an extra text for encouragement? I'm a craftsman, a task-oriented rule lover who hates being interrupted.
People who are craftsmen really enjoy remote work.
I don't really enjoy remote work, but the test predicts I would if there were other people working remotely around me. If Pepsil were advising Marketplace on optimizing my talent,
you should allow Matt to expense a WeWork so that he can be around other people.
Yeah, that's not happening. I'm going to be working out of my bedroom for the foreseeable future, and there's not much space. So how do I get help with that?
Could you have the bed here? Or it doesn't work?
Maybe.
Francoise Courtidon is a feng shui consultant based in LA. She says she's been pretty busy.
The large companies who reach out to me wanted workshops. So we had Zoom workshops with up to 100 employees.
She also does private online consultations. There's the advice you expect, like get some houseplants.
then something you can do to make your place more, I forgot the word you used, but I think you say not as crappy. I think that's what you said.
And then there's the advice you don't expect.
But here, what I see, sleeping to the east, I see extramarital affairs. I mean to tell you something else, Matt. Every single time I have seen this energy, it happens.
A $400 feng shui consultation may prevent that extramarital affair and a fortune in future alimony payments. But adding a well-placed succulent and moving the bed isn't going to make my room feel that much bigger. If only I could change my location without changing my location. Enter virtual reality.
While you can make a physical step and your avatar will move, we have a green button and you'll be able to teleport.
Oh, sweet. Christoph Fleischmann is CEO of Arthur, a virtual reality startup that creates virtual meeting rooms. He's in Vienna, I'm in California, but with an Oculus headset, it does feel like I'm in the same room as a 3D avatar of Fleischmann, or at least half of him.
We had to get rid of our legs, unfortunately. It sounds really dystopian, but allows us to get a lot more people in.
You can hold a virtual meeting in a traditional office space.
Are these fluorescent lights up here?
Fake fluorescent lights, yes. It's for those who, you know, you can't really emotionally distance themselves yet from the office experience. We have that for them.
Or opt for something more exotic. Think Bond villain lair. The tech is cool. You can write on floating whiteboards with your hand and then swat them away like a Jedi Knight. But beyond the novelty, why would a company pay up to $100 per user per month plus the headsets when they could just Zoom?
Everyone can be active at the same time. I can pull someone aside, have a side chat.
Or a high-energy brainstorm. None of that Zoom round robin. You go, then I go, then she goes. Fleischmann says it's only a matter of time before the tech gets good enough to read body language and facial micro-expressions. For now, though, he can't tell if I'm rolling my eyes or not. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
We're on week 3 of 4 of the NFL's preseason schedule, and eagle-eyed observers of that sport might have noticed something different. Back in April, the league announced it's going to relax its rules about what number a player can wear on his uniform. Specifically, it's letting tight ends, wide receivers, running backs, and defensive backs wear single-digit numbers, a privilege of sorts that used to be reserved to quarterbacks, punters, and kickers. Seems a lot of players expressed an interest in a jersey switch, but as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, there is a potentially expensive catch.
There's a lot of identity wrapped up in the numbers that NFL athletes wear. Kevin Seifert at ESPN says that's because unlike baseball and basketball players,
we don't see their faces during the games. We don't necessarily know what a lot of NFL players look like if we're just watching them in games, but their number is very recognizable.
And some players just prefer lower numbers, saying it makes them look faster or stronger. Those changes will encourage some serious fans to buy jerseys with the new numbers on them, often at $120 a pop. Over the last 4 decades, jerseys have become a real source of revenue for the league and its players. Dan Kaplan is a sports business writer at The Athletic.
Players receive 2/3 of the money that is generated by selling jerseys. The other third goes to the union, and the union sets aside some of that into a pool for all NFL players.
Here's the catch with those new jerseys, though. The NFL has long required players who request new numbers to reach into their pockets.
If it was a player's choice to do it, then he should be responsible for buying up the inventory with his name on it.
Jack Mills has been an NFL agent for about 50 years. He says if one of his clients wanted to change his jersey number,
if they have to buy a large inventory, I would think it wouldn't make sense unless somehow they thought they were going to sell a large number just because they changed jerseys.
The league told players they'd have to pay the full retail price for the old jerseys, again, about $120 each.
Not even a friends and family discount. No sort of a bulk rate buy.
Mike Florio is editor-in-chief of ProFootballTalk.com. He says Minnesota Vikings star running back Dalvin Cook looked into changing his number from 33 to 4, but he already has a lot of officially licensed gear with 33 on it available in stores, so it didn't make sense.
The price that was quoted to Dalvin Cook landed in the range of $1.5 million.
That's how much it would cost Cook to buy the stuff sold at the league's official outlets, but some smaller retailers would be left holding the bag. Vivian Ramirez runs a store called The Locker Room of Downey with her husband. It's south of Los Angeles, so they sell a lot of Rams and Chargers gear. She says the store orders jerseys from the league's official wholesaler at least a year in advance.
So it's a little bit of a gamble. You're making an investment.
And if a player changes a number, the store has to eat the cost.
You know, people just kind of get irritated. Oh, you changed the number. Now all the vendors, all the retailers like us, we're just like, oh, now we're sitting on this number. And, you know, and you weren't even a popular player.
Then there's the question of what happens to all those old jerseys? Landfill? Dumpster fire? LA Rams wide receiver Robert Woods, who's changing his number from 17 to 2, got advice from Rewilder, a sustainable design company focused on upcycling, turning old stuff into new goods, like making backpacks or jackets out of old jerseys. Jenny Silbert is the company's founder.
That is a big part of this, is the education component for fans in terms of what are ways to be more sustainable in life.
Woods still hadn't decided what to do with the old jerseys, but he's committed to making the change now, even though if he chose to wait until next season, he wouldn't have to buy the old jersey inventory. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I guess you file under, whoa, gutsy move for the new guy. The Wall Street Journal had the exclusive today that Amazon, digital retail behemoth that it is going to open a bunch of real-life retail stores, kind of like department stores, the paper says, just a little bit smaller. Clothes, household goods, electronics, all the stuff you get at, like, Macy's, I guess. The new guy, Andy Jassy, took over for founder Jeff Bezos just last month. All right, we got to be on our way, but here's your moment of economic context. It is yesterday, actually, technically, but still kind of a piece with Mitchell Hartman's new assignment to the Marketplace desk of economic peril. Goldman Sachs has cut its estimate for third quarter gross domestic product growth from 9% down to 5.5%. Still real good, but still. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Cardiant, the Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.